Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, and welcome to Your Book, the podcast of literary nosy parkers. I'm your book inspector, Daisy Buchanan. I'm the author of How to Be a Grown-Up, The Sisterhood, and my very first novel, Insatiable, A Love Story for Greedy Girls, is coming on February the 11th, 2021. Insatiable will be available online and from bookshops. There's a limited number of special signed editions available from Waterstones for Your Book listeners. Huge thanks to everyone who has already pre-ordered. It's the very best way for you to support the podcast. Also, we're really delighted to tell you that from today, we're supporting Books to Nourish to raise money for Fair Share, and you can bid for a chance to be on the podcast. I will interview the winning bidder or the person of their choice, either in their home if they're UK-based or Zoom if they're elsewhere, or if they prefer to do it over Zoom, about their books and bookshelves, their life as a reader and books they love the most. And the guest, if they're UK-based, will also get a delicious bundle of books from the Your Book Proof Pile. The episode will be shared on all major podcast platforms with Your Book listeners. For more information, visit bookstonourish.wordpress.com and check out at YBooked on Twitter and Instagram for information and to find out about how to bid. Now on to today's guest. Best-selling author, beloved comedian and joint taskmaster runner-up, it's the writer, joker and overachiever Mark Watson. We talked about his brand new book, Contacts, loving Sarah Waters, falling in love with Flann O'Brien, and how the current lack of plane journeys is seriously cutting into our reading time. I wanted to start by asking you about reading and mental health. And, you know, in the new novel, there's a very, moving and explicit and resonant discussion about, you know, mental health. And I think how it's something that we all have and that we all struggle with. And I was wondering if there are any novels or any other books that you found really comforting or inspiring or that have helped you through hard times.
It's not an easy question to answer because I think like a lot of people, I have not always found it easy to focus on reading when things have been bad mentally. I think that, you know, there's quite a lot of, it's a paradox really. As you say, a book can really transport you mentally. But at the very moment you need that most, you sometimes don't have the mental energy to invest. One book I would, there are someone's at the door. It's just everything way out of my control. One book does come to mind is Derren Brown wrote a book on happiness, specifically on the subject of happiness. It's just called Happy. It's not a novel. It's a kind of quite lengthy, exhaustive non-fiction book about the history of different ideas of happiness, but then it also has a kind of self-help aspect to it. And Derren Brown is someone I find quite inspiring as a thinker. Obviously, I love kind of him as a magician and trickster, but he's also very perceptive about the way the brain works. And so although someone who's like a TV illusionist might not seem like an obvious place to go for wisdom on how to be happy, he's got a very forensic way of looking at the mind, because I suppose that's his business. So I found that a really fascinating book. He's just written a follow-up to it called A Little Happier, which is a kind of very slim companion piece, which I've bought and I can see it from where I'm sitting. It's this close, but I'm sure you're the same. I can see an awful lot of books in my house that I would love to read, and I'm not going to for the time being. I will read his, but you may be about the same age as me. I'm definitely at the stage of life where I already know I'm not going to ever read every one of the books that I want to, and I'm still acquiring books.
Oh God, I think a kind of snow blindness sets in, and I know the number, you know, when I finish a book and I have that real panic of like, oh, but what do I do next? And that's the paralysis of choice, like, you know, going into an empty car park.
I know, and if there's one area of life where choice paralysis kicks in, it is books. I reckon that you only got to walk into a bookshop and immediately you're absolutely overwhelmed by the, especially if you've written a book as well, it does, if you need bringing down to earth, it's quite a reality check when you see how many other books just that day, how many other books have arrived in the bookshops. It never ends. And an average trip through Waterstones, I could easily pick up a dozen books that about each of which I would think, oh, this would be great, I'd love to do this. And unfortunately I don't have time quite for any of them at the moment. A lot of people find audiobooks are a good way of doing it, because it's just, you know, you can sort of do that while getting on with other tasks. But I'm not very good at that. I've not yet got the hang of listening to books, really. I like to have it in my hands.
I suppose with an audiobook, what's tricky sometimes is, you know, I think we're so used, aren't we? And I wonder if, because I've not read that Derren Brown book yet. I would love to. It's one of the thousands on the pile.
And it's big as well. It's off-puttingly large, you know.
That's why I thought, could I start with the second one first? Do the slimmer one?
I'll report back to you. Maybe the small one it looks like about 100 pages. It feels more like a sort of B-sides album. So maybe just read that and you'll feel as if you've got the gist of the much, much longer one.
But, you know, I think there's this weird stress and pressure we're all under to sort of optimise everything. And I think that, you know, reading, and decide, well, if I'm listening to an audiobook, I can do something else, and just to sort of submit to a single, you know, voluptuous pleasure. Especially because I do think reading, no matter what we're reading, I think there is something useful and nourishing and to be gained, whether that's it could be a sci-fi novel or a very, you know, serious and practical book about like how to rewire your house. But, you know, there's something there for us. But I think that sometimes when that feels obscure and not obvious, it's really hard for a person to make the time to do that.
Oh, I absolutely agree. And I think that's perhaps why I haven't warmed to audiobooks as an idea, because I sort of don't want to be doing something at the same time. I mean, I don't drive. Maybe if I drove, I'd have. But now I can't even imagine that, because I'd have to concentrate really hard on the driving. But I mean, I'm happy if people consume my books in any format, but I think I'd find it quite hard. And in fact, I recorded an audiobook for this one. And as I was doing it, it's the first time I've done that. I did sort of think what it would be like for someone to listen to it. And yeah, I don't know that I've got the mental capacity to grasp the plot of a novel while also looking after my kids or doing emails. But also, as you say, that's not really the point. The point is you want to be fully immersed. Some of the best, most satisfying reading I've done over the past couple of years is, very, very little of this year. But last year I flew a lot. I traveled a lot. I went to Japan and the USA. It's almost weird to even be saying it. And on those flights, people often ask, what did you watch? What movie did you watch on the plane? But I never do watch movies on planes, because it's when I do the reading of long books. And I read a lengthy novel pretty much start to finish over the course of a return trip to Tokyo. And it was, nourishing is the word, I think. It was a wonderful experience. 9 or 10 hours with absolutely no focus apart from, I suppose I was drinking wine as well. But when I'm reading on a plane, which, as I say, I will often save a long book specifically if I know I've got a flight coming up. I do think, because there's very, very little else to think about on an aeroplane, it is one of the purest forms of reading sensation. And it takes me back to when I was like 16 and didn't have much else to worry about and could just set aside time to read a book. It's a really, since you brought it up, I do think about this a lot. You know, the simple truth that reading numbers decline because all of us are busier and we consume entertainment in different forms, and that's fine. But an audiobook is not quite the same as a book, is it? Because as soon as you do start combining book reading with 6 other tasks, it's not quite the same as what we think of as reading a book. It interests me. I don't know what the answer is, because I don't see us all going back to reading by candlelight. But I do sometimes worry about what it means for our psychological setup that we don't have that space in our lives anymore.
It's true. I'm going back a bit. What was it that you were reading on that flight to Tokyo?
It was a book called, and again I can see it up there, it's called I Still Dream by someone called James Smythe, his name is, or it might be pronounced Smith actually. It's a sort of sci-fi novel, and I hardly ever read any sci-fi. I don't think of it as my thing, well, isn't my thing. I've got no, genuinely have very little interest in. I'm not snobbish about it. It's just not my world, really. But this is a book about, it must have been almost exactly this time last year, because I was in Japan on this day last year, it strikes me. So it's a year ago, and it's really stayed with me. It's a book basically about somebody who builds a very, very powerful artificial intelligence assistant thing, like Alexa or Siri. I asked on Twitter, does anybody know of a good novel about the phenomenon of specifically the artificial intelligence helper, because I had sort of an idea to write something about it, and I think it's fascinating. I think the idea of delegating more and more of your decisions to just an unseen thing in your phone like that is weirds me out, but I also think it's very interesting. So anyway, this someone pointed this book out to me, and it begins in the 90s and goes through the present day into the future, and just looks at the ways it's sort of quite a positive book. There's plenty of books about how AI will become so popular that, so powerful that it just overwhelms us. Or at least I assume there's plenty of books about that, because that feels like it's been a trope for a long time.
Yeah,
we made robots, they got better than us, and they wrecked us. It is a well-worn trope. This is a book about the ways we might be able to enrich ourselves as a humanity through artificial intelligence. So it's really, really interesting. I think James Smythe, by the look of it, build as like a sci-fi writer for people who don't normally like sci-fi, and it did work.
I was going to say, I'm sold, because I think I'm the same as you. I like things that are sort of as real as it gets, and I'm terrible for, like, if it's set too far in the future or too far in the past, I get freaked out. Ideally, anything between about 1920 and 1995, I'm very, very happy in that world. I don't want to work out how they went to the toilet in Tudor times.
Yeah, this is that's the thing, isn't it? I'm glad you said that, because I often do feel it's a bit of a shortcoming of mine as a reader. Like, I judged a book prize once, the Costa Prize. It was a first novel category. So I'd read about 60 odd novels in reasonably short order. And it was a great experience, amazing to see all these people's minds. Although a lot of the entries were much better than I'd expected. Oh, I don't know what I expected. But anyway, yeah, there were some where I'd pick it up and it would say, the year is 18, and immediately I'm like, oh, is it? It's really fun. I remember, someone recommended the book to me for my sister. I said, oh, it's a thriller. My sister loves thrillers. Someone recommended one to me, said, oh, this is great. It's one of the most exciting thrillers I've ever. But then I picked it up in Waterstones, and it said, we're in Iceland. It is 1742. And I thought, nah, my sister's, that's not a Christmas present. That's worse. Also, I mean, yeah, it's funny you mention how do people go to the toilet in Tudor times, because one thing that makes it, I can't imagine being able to write a book set so far in the past that you'd have to research essentially every detail. I do think I don't read many of these books, but I do admire people for doing it.
I think perhaps what makes, because I think if I were writing one, I would be so almost, it was like I'd want to show my working, that I'm scared that people aren't going to sort of spend huge, you know, thousands, and because they're often enormous books, aren't they? It's like, oh, are people feel like I've done so much research and I need to show all the research I've done? And I think there are brilliant, brilliant books that do it beautifully where you don't see it so much. Like, I'm sort of hugely popular book, but I don't know if you ever read, and it's not really quite the, but also it's the 70s and it's California and it's a place where I was very happy to hang out. Did you read Daisy Jones and the Six?
Actually, no, I haven't read that, although I do know about it, yeah.
I would say if you want to get back into reading and you're finding reading quite stressful and it's just another chore in this horrible, horrible year of our Lord 2020, it's written as an oral history, and it's so engaging and immediate, and it's about a 70s rock band in LA. So you're by the pool in Chateau Marmont most of the time. Everyone's happy. They're not having a lovely time. It's sort of a psychosexual drama of hell in a lot of places, but it's...
Oh, that's fine. I don't know if I want to read about people having a lovely time right now.
It's so well researched, but also it's written with such skillful lightness. You don't feel as though Taylor Jenkins Reid is sort of, look, I spent so much of my life learning about all of this stuff.
It's interesting, isn't it? I do remember, in fact, that being a thing that, and again, these were first novels, so you can kind of understand it, but something I did find irksome in some of the historical novels when I was doing this mastery was exactly what you're talking about. It was that he walked up the steps of the old police building, which had been torn down 10 years ago and rebuilt, of course, and as he paused, he thought about how the rails have been done. hang on a minute. Do you mean you've just been to the British Library for a bit?
Said no one ever. Has anyone ever walked into a building and thought, oh, what were those railings like 10 years ago?
I know. I made that example up, but Jeff, definitely, if you see a historical character stop and ponder something which seems a bit odd, you always suspect it's just that the author was keen to get that in. I'll tell you a good example. I do think of someone who seems to be able to do it effortlessly. I suppose this is not exactly news, but I think Sarah Waters is amazing. Mm. Because that is somebody who seems to, I know she researches incredibly exhaustively because I've seen her interviewed, and she says she'll spend a year in the library, you know, before even putting pen to paper, which is the sort of thing that absolutely terrifies me as a notion.
Same.
She says that, or she said in some interview that that's her favourite bit. The research was almost meant more to her than, and she deliberately chose periods like the interwar period with a little stranger, or that she didn't know much about, you know, so that she could have the pleasure of immersing herself in that. And all this I find incredibly impressive, but there's no way on earth I'm going to spend a year learning about a historical period before I can even begin writing.
Are there any of her novels that you've read and loved?
Almost all of them, actually. I'm a real Waters fan. The trouble with being a Waters fan is that there's ages between the books, though, for this very reason, I guess. There's not been one that I didn't enjoy, but I think the Little Stranger I did think was a brilliant book and a great example of a thriller that's propelled by just pure atmosphere, basically, which is often something that I wouldn't really like. I like plot. I don't like it often when, you know, it annoys me sometimes when you see books, high-end literature, like prize list books, and you sort of read it and it's been very well-written, but there's sort of nothing happens. You could never say that about Sarah Waters' book. But also, I mean, even Fingersmith, I suppose, is like maybe the most celebrated one. It's an incredibly well-realised Victorian world. But I don't remember ever thinking that the research showed heavily. You know, she's so light, so deft about taking you into that world. If anyone could cure me of not wanting to read books set in the distant past, it is her. If she went for an Elizabethan setting or something, I would trust her. but that said, I'd be delighted if I find out the next one is just in the 80s or something.
Sarah Waters, if you're listening, Elizabethan book, Regency or New Romantic, or maybe a sort of time slip between the two.
Yeah, she's one of the only authors that if that was the blurb, I'd be like, all right then. I think it might be that The Little Stranger was the first one I read, if I'm not mistaken. And that is set, you know, relatively recently, like the 50s. So then that was my sort of soft launch with Waters. And then I think I probably had, not consciously, but I think I'd gone, that I skipped Sarah Waters because I was like, oh, this it sounds like work. The best compliment you could give it is that at no point, I read an interview with her and she said, and I hope I'm not misquoting her, but she said something like, as an author, your job is to put a reader on a funfair ride on the first page and just keep them on the ride till they get off, something like that. And that is, in my head, as a writer, that is, I mean, I hope I'm remembering it right because it's constantly in my head. I don't think she meant that every page of every book has to be, you know, spinning you around. And I think she just meant your responsibility to a reader is to stimulate them and excite, or even excite is the wrong word, because not every page of every book has to make you gasp, but just something about that sense that you've signed up for a ride and let's go on that ride. I find that a really lovely precept for writing.
It's, and also that you want to stay on, that there's so, it's a weird, like there are, there's so much happening, but you're rooted at one spot. Now, I wanted to ask you about, you know, when you were a teenager and before, what were those early books that you read that were the first things that you chose for yourself where you thought, this is for me, this is what reading is about?
When I was a real kid, like 9 or 10, I was, you know, obsessed with football, and I still am, but that was one of my earliest obsessions. So I read a lot of like sporty, football-y type literature. But then weirdly, in my teenage, the first books I remember really forming my, this is for me, reading patterns were Agatha Christie novels. I got obsessed with Agatha Christie when I was a teenager I think it's because in English class we had to read, so I was 11, you had to choose a proper novel, read it. A novel meant for adults. It was kind of quite ballsy assignment that an English teacher set us. Like go into the school library, find a book which was not aimed at you, an 11-year-old, and read it. And it was Murder on the Orient Express, and I'd heard of it. That was all it was. I was like, well, I believe this is a famous novel. I'll have a go at this. And obviously, I was mesmerized by it, because if you've never really read like a whodunit before when you're 11, it blows your mind. And then I discovered that there were absolutely hundreds of Agatha Christie books. So I became, especially Poirot, I was really sold on the idea of Poirot. I haven't read a Christie book for years, and I don't normally watch the TV ones either, but I do, I can still see what was so seductive about it. There's something so pure about, and there's much more advanced detective fiction out there, but something about this guy just showing up at the hotel, having a quick look around, being puzzled, but you know he's gonna get there. You know there's that moment where he says, "Oh, I'll tell you who did it, him." There's something very, very attractive about that, I think. And as an adult, I've read a couple of like Ian Rankin's, and I don't, and those are good, but I've never been very interested in like police procedural novels, stuff like that. I think what I'm in it for with a whodunit is passionate about it. I like a sort of Poirot or Marple-esque genius to appear, and just same with telly. I never really like it when you're in a police station and they're analysing the clues and they're looking at stuff. I'm old fashioned. I just like a gentleman detective to roll up and say, and I'll tell you why it was her, because she's left handed. You know, I love stuff like that. And definitely as a kid, so I used to just mainline those. I would take three or four out of the school library.
I can imagine the moment when you're sort of so gripped by it. And like, holy hell, there's hundreds of these.
It was a real moment, because I think when I picked Orient Express, it was on a display. It wasn't with the other Christie books. It was just on some sort of display. So it was only when I went and looked under C for Christie, I was like, Christ, there's 50 of these. I was very lucky to have our school had a fantastic library. So they did have loads of them in. And then I started to seek them out in my local library. And I don't know how many I read. There'll still be plenty that I didn't read, because obviously she was unbelievably prolific. But I did, between the ages of about, I'd say maybe 13 and 15 or 16, I read loads of them. I'd take them on holiday and stuff like that. And again, even now I can really connect with that part of me that was, they're all the same length, like 200 pages. You clatter through them and you know that about 4/5 of the way through, you'll find out everything. And you know that every 50 pages or so, one of the suspects will be bumped off as well. I suppose it's sort of formulaic, but I do sometimes think she's underrated still, because that sort of plotting is like witchcraft to me, being able to think of those things.
And as you said, and you've not got, I do think that now in the CSI times, when the technology is such that sort of, it ruins it, that the idea that it's just someone being ingenious and really, really observing and paying attention. Because that's what you do as a reader as well. You get to be Poirot.
Exactly. A friend of mine, a clever friend of mine called Rose, said that all reading is basically an act of detection. Whatever the book is, your brain is basically being Poirot. Even if it's not a whodunit or a mystery, your brain is decoding, and you're right, that's exactly the appeal of it. You get people that watch these things or read it, like my mum, for example, and immediately goes, "Oh, I think I know." And I was never into that. I never even tried to guess. I'd never even wanted to be Poirot. I was more like Hastings. I like being the guy that's like, "Well, I've got no bloody idea, have you?"
That's much more fun.
I think so. I don't like watching things with people who claim to have worked it out in 20 minutes, whether it's true or not. I'm just like, shut up and just experience it at the pace that the author wanted us to.
Believe in their skill.
I can still remember how haunted I was by, I can't remember what it was. I think it was called A Murder Is Announced, where there's a murder mystery party and then a real murder at that, which is a classic Christie sort of conceit. And I remember one of the characters that you've got quite attached to being murdered halfway. That was one of the things about Agatha Christie. Someone else will always die before you get to the answer. That feeling when the unknown murderer is starting to get desperate and they start killing other people who know. There's nothing as creepy as that. And Agatha Christie's amazing at that.
But I think that's the funfair ride, isn't it? That's sort of the handbrake turn where you're rooted to your seat.
Exactly. And I suppose, it's an underrated skill to be able to write books like that where there are three or four moments where the reader is exactly spun round all over again. The irony with all this analogy is I hate actual funfair rides. There's never been a roller coaster I get off in real life. reading books is about as adrenalised as I want my life to become, I think.
If you were to, I don't know, something in the world has changed, everything's fine, you can fly to Australia, what book do you take with you?
Firstly, I'm really pleased even to picture this. I used to go to Australia every year for comedy festivals there. And so this is a good example of a flight where I actively, I'm trying to think. There was a book I read on a flight to Australia last year called The Overstory by Richard Powers, which is this enormous novel about trees, basically. That was very, very good, but I didn't even, it's so long that even Australia and back isn't enough for it. And I'm not sure I'll go back to that because I did finish it in the end, but like, I'm trying to think of a substantial book that
That's
is...
That's interesting because I saw that and I remember, was that long listed for the Booker?
I think it was, yeah. It's an American book, but they can do that these days, of course.
I did something last year where I was, I did some presenting on BBC News for the Booker yeah. Prize and it was, and I had to read Duck's Newburyport.
That's a good example.
That's a big old book. And I was massively resentful of Duck's Newburyport. And I was like, oh, my God. And it's not just that it's enormous, but it's one sentence long.
Well, yeah, I picked it up in the bookshop and thought, Jesus Christ. Like when I actually opened it and saw what it was, it seemed even less likely I could ever get through that.
So I'd had to sort of, I'd set a timer for an hour and just go and see how much I could kind of get in. And I was really, wow. really daunted. And then after about, I think, 2.5 hour chunks, because also the way it's written, I thought, there's no possible way I can remember what's going on. This is so dense.
Yeah.
And it got in my head and I fell in love with it. And the narrator just lodged with me. And I'd be thinking about her all the time and things would sort of float up. And I was just astonished. It was such a feat. And it's one of those, like, it's the book that has surprised me the most. So after that, maybe I ought to have a go at The Overstory.
Well, it makes me wonder if I should have a go at that, because like most people who weren't directly working on the Booker Prize, I looked at it and thought, I just don't think I can. And all of the reactions I've ever seen to that book have either been, trust me, this is the most amazing experience, or I got 50 pages in and it was absolutely pointless. So I'm not sure which side I'd come down on, but it does feel as if that, if there's ever been an example of a book that you save for a plane, it's probably that, because it feels like you'd have to do it in substantial chunks, otherwise you wouldn't. It's not something, you can't pick that up in the bath and then read 5 pages.
And I think maybe like you, I've always believed like reading has to be just, you know, fun above all. It's something that should sort of serve us and be joyous.
Absolutely.
And if you want to reread your old Sweet Valley High books, which I always do, but reading Ducks, I was like, oh, it is a muscle and this is hard. But I like for the first time I've remembered that sometimes it's really, really good to challenge yourself. Yeah, and that the harder it is really up front, the more you get out.
I find that really interesting. I mean, like I it's sort of how I feel about running, I suppose. I do quite a lot of running. It's one of my main hobbies, I suppose you'd call it, but like most runners, before it starts I always think, I don't want to do this at all. And reading a difficult book maybe is a bit like that. You have to invest something, but the rewards you do multiply. And yeah, that's the thing, it's interesting, isn't it, because I remember seeing, and I can't remember her name unfortunately, the author of Ducks,
Lucy Ellman.
I saw some sort of interview with her. She says something along the lines of, I don't care if you think it's too long, I wrote the book that I was going to write, there's not a length that I'm meant to write to, or something along those lines. And I really admired that. I was like, well yeah, if your idea is 900 pages long, then do it. But yeah, I agree with you. There's a book called The Marlowe Papers by someone called Roz Barber, and it's a novel in verse, and it's all about this. So again, set in the old days, about the idea that Christopher Marlowe wrote the plays of Shakespeare secretly, this thing which comes up sometimes. So the book follows Marlowe, but all of it, nothing against the idea of a verse novel. I've read a couple in my time, but I did look at it and think, this is unlikely to be fun. And I was absolutely wrong. I loved it. And yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Again, it comes down to time. We've got so little time to read that it's a big call to pick up something which you're not convinced is going to be fun. Because if it's not fun, then what is it? But as you also said, there are different forms of fun, and having your mind messed with and opened up and like reset a bit by a tough book is fun in its own right. You've just got to make yourself do it in the first place.
At the moment, I'm reading State of Wonder by Anne Patchett. And that's something that I think I would have thought before, oh, I don't really fancy going to the jungle and there's been a murder and there are lots of terrifying poisonous snakes and bugs. I was really surprised by how gripped I was. I don't love violence in books, and I don't love major actual peril. But I read I read The Dutch House earlier this year. I get a feeling quite reluctant and quite like, oh, this is going to be quite heavy and quite literary and quite dry and lots of describing of things. And it was just so immediate.
I think we're quite similar as readers. When you said lots of describing of things, I also had that feeling in the pit of my stomach. Oh, don't describe it too much. It's so funny because I don't know if it was which year it was, but I remember the year that the head of the Booker panel said they were looking for books that zipped along nicely or some phrase like that. And she got into so much trouble from the book establishment for that. I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to expect of a book that there's a feeling of pace and momentum and excitement. Again, it doesn't mean it has to be short. It's just, it's the immediacy. It's exactly what you said. I don't think an author should make you feel as if you have to meet them halfway. I don't think that you should spend 20 pages thinking, why am I being told this much detail? Or, you know, I feel like it's a bit like, and again, it feels like it can seem like quite a shallow point of view, but it's when, like when there's some TV series you've never watched and people are like, I mean, the first 7 episodes aren't great, but if you stick with it, again, like, that's 7 hours of television. I feel like that with books as well. Sometimes people will say about a book, if you just, you just got to stick in there for 100 pages. But again, I'm like, well, I mean, do I though? Would it have killed the author to just seduce me from page one?
Well, I guess that I was thinking about comedy and how, you know, comedians can't afford to spend hours and, you know, or minutes even setting things up. It seems bizarre that readers are expected to give so much of themselves before the yield when you're like, you know, you've got 5 minutes to blow people away.
I think that might be why I feel like that about books, because I don't get to go on stage and spend 25 minutes just talking about my childhood and how I got to this point, or my grandparents. So that's one of my one thing I will mark a book down for mentally is when you, even before you meet the characters, you hear how their parents met, and then maybe their, you know, like if a book starts with someone's grandparents meeting, I'm like, can we get to the actual people? Unless there's a very specific reason why I'm being told this.
She first saw him paddling his canoe. The canoe was carved from ancient wood that was from a yew tree.
Just like, right, okay, fine. Unless this is important. And I could, again, I don't want to sound like some sort of junk food reader. I just always think it's important for a writer, and I'm not... certainly no expert on, I'm in no position to advise people how to write, but I do think I think a writer should think exactly how much information does the reader need at any given moment. It's a real sinking feeling when you invest in two characters that have met and fallen in love and stuff, and then you realise they're only the grandparents. So now I've got to forget those people and care about this girl instead, have I?
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
We'll be back to Mark soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week. I've chosen a book that just made me feel so much joy and cheer during a time when there's been a real dearth of it. Between the Covers, a collection of Jilly Cooper's best Sunday Times columns, is a tonic. It's so wise, gorgeous, generous, funny and human. If you like champagne and sexy dresses and good times, and you want to feel better about your chipped toenails, your excessive fondness for biscuits and your sink full of washing up, come on down. Between the Covers is published by Bantam and it's out now. The audiobook is narrated by former guest and friend of the cast, Pandora Sykes. Now, back to Mark. Other than the books you've mentioned, is there anything that comes into your head? If you're like, what's a book that gripped you from the first page?
There are two or three books in answer to a question that I can see which I loved. But I can't really remember much about the start or anything at all. Sometimes there's a book which I would say I love, but I can't. I've just looked across at this book, Ragtime by E.L. Doctorow, quite a famous novel, I think, American, like mid-century novel about the jazz era. This is the thing. All I remember is that I really, really enjoyed it, but I couldn't tell you anything about it at all. but there is one. I use this book a lot as an example of good writing. It's by Moshin Hamid is his name, although I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. But and the book is called How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia. And again, it's a brief book written in the second person, I suppose it is, so that you do this, you do that, very unusual. So it's sort of written like a handbook on how to get rich in modern Asia. But it follows two characters, a male and female character. And again, I don't exactly remember how it started, but I do remember instantly buying into it, thinking this is beautiful. He also wrote a book called Exit West recently. They are quite brief books, both of these. He also wrote a book called The Reluctant Fundamentalist, which is quite a bit longer, and I haven't read that, so draw your own conclusions. that's the thing. It's not about laziness on the part of a reader. It's just that it's not even about brevity. It's just something about, he writes in a way, certainly, where you feel as if, as a reader, the author is saying, come with me, I'm going to tell you some things straight away. I don't think it's wrong to want that. I remember reading 1984 when I was a kid, well, a teenager, like almost everyone did when they were teenagers. And there's that thing about it was a bright, cold day and the clocks were just striking 13. Winston Smith, you meet him within a paragraph, you know. And again, snobs will say, you don't need to learn everything you have to know within the first page. But I think I'd say, yeah, but it's nice if you do, though. But certainly as a teenager, and I suppose a lot of people sneer at Orwell as like, yeah, those are the novels that you like when you're a teenager. And maybe that's true. But I do remember that was an important book in my reading development, because I thought, here is a book that has a famous literary status, and yet I'm instantly in the world. I don't feel too stupid for it.
But I think, you know, the urgency and economy of it will always, always work, and it will always move you. Yeah. And I think that's so appealing. And, you know, because when you're, I think when one is a teenager, you know, that's when you're kind of at your keenest and sharpest, and you don't want to kind of meander. And it really, you know, it's such a gift to grab people and say, like, oh, yeah. I mean, I was thinking how, like, absolutely, oh, it's a book the teenagers like, I think there's no greater compliment, because all of your feelings are so vivid and so extreme, and you are so prepared to go where someone will take you. And if an author has been taking teenagers on that journey, God, when was 1984 written? 48, I should know.
I think it was 48, because I think he spot the digits around. Yeah.
That's what, nearly 70 years? Over 70 years?
It must have been just the 70th anniversary just gone, I guess. Yeah, yeah.
To have been propelling teenagers for 70 years, blimey.
If you've ever met a teenager, I don't think you would sneer at the achievement of holding down the attention of a teenager for 200 pages. Yeah, yeah. To be able to write a book which, you know, not necessarily politically engages, but which has made successions, generations of teenagers and students, young people, think about power, totalitarianism, you know, number, all the things it does, is, yeah, really a hell of an achievement. In fact, the fact that 1984 is so relatively easily read and absorbed by almost anyone, incredible achievement, the more you think about it, because, and that's just the thing with literary snobbery, there is this idea that any sort of populism in writing is automatically to be looked down on, but why wouldn't you want the book to reach as many people as possible if you thought it was worth writing it at all? And why is it not an achievement for somebody to be able to transport that many people, especially when books are, you know, as we said, any book is a difficult sell to a chaotic world like this. So yeah, there should be very little shame in them. My only exception is the only books I look down on are celeb memoirs, or well, books which have been clearly cynically engineered and published to sell to as many people as possible. But I don't think there's any fiction about that I'd feel like that about, because if you can find a million people who want to read something, then good luck to you, I reckon.
And I think that even then, maybe there are some, you know, celeb memoirs that they get people into reading.
You're right. There's no grounds for snobbery, really, because yeah, any book that causes someone to be interested in the idea of picking up a book has got to be better than not having it. You're right. I suppose what I'm thinking of is specific examples of people I know who've been approached to write a book because they're famous and the publishers, you know, all the publishers are thinking is if her face was in it on the cover of that would sell loads. But yeah, even then, I mean, if that's a couple of hundred thousand people that wouldn't normally fancy going into a bookshop, yeah, there are no downsides to books being written and published, except that there are too many of them for my ones to get attention.
That's it. It's going into water stains. But there's a problem here. You have thousands of books and only a percentage of those books are mine. They should all be mine.
Sometimes I'm next to Sarah Waters on the shelves as well, alphabetically.
Oh, nice, of course.
Quite often, in fact, my mum is always going into bookshops to check if they have my book, and I don't normally succumb to that sort of egoism. But occasionally I'll have a look at the W's if I'm an author, and not infrequently they won't have any of my books, but they always will have a full set of Waters, and it's useful to have. And also Jeanette Winterston. There are quite a few real heavyweights around my section of the W's, so sometimes it is a humbling experience to look at the shelves.
That's advice for writers, isn't it? Change your surname, check the letters, and find an obscure letter.
Yeah, see if you can have a surname which doesn't occur too close to a really, really popular writer.
You could dominate the X's.
Yeah, get yourself a letter which not too many people have snapped up. You don't want to be called something anything like Stephen King. Actually, that's at least Waters has only written about, I don't know, half a dozen books, and Winterston, not too many. Probably the worst thing is if you're too alphabetically close to a really prolific author, then the entire show, you're not even on the shelf.
Can you remember the last book you bought in a bookshop that surprised you? Or did you find yourself in a section or an area you wouldn't usually, and you were...
That's an interesting question again. There definitely have been plenty, because I do that. I regularly pick up a book, think, I'm not going to buy this, am I? And then I'm at the checkout.
And putting your pin in a trance.
Yeah. That's why it's one of the things, I mean, I suppose you can still go to bookshops, of course, but one of the things I do miss when I'm not in a bookshop, one of the things you can't replicate, and it's why book sales are struggling or have struggled, even though we still have, people think everything is about Amazon and stuff, but a surprising number of book decisions are just made by that moment of being in a shop and thinking, yeah, why not? And that's as a sort of like, low ranking author, that's where you pick up some of your trade. Just the one thing is, and I don't know how I even feel about the book really, but Extinction Rebellion's handbook, This Is Not a Drill, about climate change, was a book that I saw everywhere, because it's the sort of book that if you're in Waterstones, they have it there by the counter, one of those books that trap you. And I think for that very reason I was like, well, I'm not buying that. I'm not buying Matt Haig's tiny book about anxiety, and that's nothing to do with him, just any book that looks as if they've put it out there to trip me over on the way, I'm like, I resent. Or that it's often those books like funny book about Brexit, funny book about this stuff, like Christmas stocking type books, but all year round, stuff like that, I'm like, no, I'm not spending another £5 just because you put that there. And then about the sixth time it happened, I picked it up and thought, well, I mean, this is a book about the end of days and whether we can stave it off, why am I not engaging with it? So I did buy it, but it certainly, yeah, it definitely comes in the category of surprise purchase, because not only was I not going to buy it, I'd consciously thought, nah, I'm not having it. And of course it was very interesting, very, very easily read, quite troubling. Yeah, there was another book on the same subject actually, called by Jonathan Safran Foer, called We Are the Weather. Again, about the planet and what we can do about it. And it's not that I'm not interested in it. Everyone's interested in climate change if they're not mad. It just, I think it comes back to this fun thing. It doesn't seem as if it's going to be fun. And I've read his novels before, like Everything is Illuminated. But that was obviously not in the fiction section. I'd somehow wandered into a section about climate or something, and I recognised his name. But again, I remember holding it in my hand thinking, well, this sounds interesting, but I can't really, I don't see myself leaving the shop with it. And again, within 5 minutes, I had done.
Something almost happens, a sort of mist descends, obviously.
Yeah, I almost feel like once I've got a book, once I've picked up a book in a shop, I'm almost destined to buy it, it seems like. Like, even if I've done the work of picking it up and reading about it, it feels as if that's 80% of the way to buying it, really. Partly because books are so skillfully blurbed these days. Almost any book you read the cover of, you think, oh, that sounds amazing.
I think one of Daphne du Maurier's last books, and I can't think what it's called, and I've not actually read it, but weirdly, it's, I think it, I'm going to get this horribly wrong, I think it might have been published in the 70s. I'm looking over at producer Dale, who's nodding. It's kind of about Brexit, but way before Brexit.
Right.
And there's a quote on the front, there's an edition, an early edition with a quote on the front from, I think, the Daily Mirror. And the quote is something like, this is a book about what would happen if Britain left the European Union. Like, do you not want to say, like, a great read or hugely entertaining?
That's funny.
Or not, like, it's very...
It's just a little description of the content. Yeah. Sometimes you can spot it. I mean, all books, obviously all books have got some sort of quote on and something. But I think, again, because of comedy, because of my line of work, I know how to spot a quote that's been just snipped a little bit or slightly given a spin, because there are certain words like fascinating or... which, if they appear out of any context, you think, well, that could easily have been, this fascinating idea is ruined by the execution or something like that.
Fascinating, .. Nothing else.
Exactly. Generally, I think you should be suspicious of one-word quotes, because you could pretty much lift that out of any sentence and could have said, this book is not that fascinating. Also, my editor, or my old editor, Francesca, and I used to talk about this, but we both, despite being big bookworms, we both share some of the like kind of suspicions that you and I have been talking about, of like overambitious books, too difficult books, and so on. Even though she's an incredibly voracious reader, she's an editor and she publishes incredibly ambitious books. Our thing was always sweeping. If a book is described as sweeping, that which is it's something you see in quotes quite often, but that is borderline not a compliment at all. I'd say that might well mean that it takes place in five different centuries and you don't know where the hell you are. At the very least, sweeping is likely to mean an enormous number of characters.
You're going to have to keep going back to the front to check who everyone is.
Oh, I hate that. If a book starts with a family tree or a map, straight away, am I going to be flicking back and forth constantly? I think that's one of the things I love about that book, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, is, again, it sounds like laziness, but I don't think it is. I think it's a defensible thing for readers to like. It is about basically just a guy and a girl getting older. It's a series of vignettes of that happening. And you know quite early on, you're only going to have to invest in those two people. And again, I think that's a brilliant skill. I think to be able to make a reader care desperately about two people and almost nothing else is, I don't think that's to be looked down either. And again, I don't think as a reader, there's any, I suppose one day is the same, to take more famous example, I heard someone say about One Day by David Nichols, all it is just these two people and you see them every year and that's it. And to me, that's a huge compliment.
Yeah.
To be able to execute an idea as simple and clean as that is that skill, I think.
Because what's so masterful about One Day and the way he builds those characters is that it's, as a reader, it's so easy to kind of fill in the gaps so clearly. You're not there going like, well, I need to know what's happening to Emma when it's not July. You sort of know.
Reading it, I was really envious of how well it had been executed. I do think he's a very good writer, Dave Nichols. And I exactly what you said. It's like how much a reader needs to and doesn't need to know at any given moment is such a fine art to work that out, I think. Because you're right, I don't think you ever wonder what happened to the characters in the year since you last saw them in that book. You just fill in the gaps. Occasionally you're told, but loads of the time you're not told. I do think that's really clever. I think it's so easy to over-inform a reader when you're writing. I'm constantly doing it. You read drafts back and you think, yeah, why did we really need to know how he felt about his grandmother's house? You just thought at one time the reader might want to know that. But judging that is the difference between a good writer and a mediocre one, I think. We keep coming back to it. I think urgency is the word you use. I think that's a good word. I think everything that it's fine to be discursive. It's fine we're going off on a tangent for 20 pages now. Fine. But there needs to be some sense of urgency about, again, I think it might come from the instincts of a stand-up. If I'm telling an anecdote on stage, I can only afford to include what needs to be said. Mm. Otherwise, I'm wasting time. And I know that a book is a different type of much longer pleasure. So I'm not saying that I don't think an author should race through the way that a stand-up races through a routine. But there is something about, do they need to know this? Is it helping them? That is not a bad thing to have in mind, I think.
I wonder, and this might require a little bit of thinking, if you could time travel to any point and go back and blurb a writer that you love, Agatha Christie, who do you think you'd pick?
Yeah, I think I can answer this. One of my favourite books, certainly growing up, but I reckon I'd still have it in my top 20 or so, is I hate being asked for those sort of lists because you know what it's like. You can immediately think of a thousand. But a book that's been important to me over the years is called The Third Policeman by Flann O'Brien.
Yes, I love that
book. Do you know it? I think it's true to say everybody that's ever read it loved or loathed it. It's one of those. It's very hard to describe, but it's a deranged, weird comic masterpiece that takes place in a sort of parallel universe. Everything is perfectly recognisable and normal. Like there's no, we wouldn't call it sci-fi, but escalating series of baffling things happen to a central character, basically. I think I've got a soft spot for books like that. I loved The Majors when I was a student as well, by John Fowles. And that's, in a way, not dissimilar. Someone goes to a place, more and more and more mad things happen to them, and they don't understand why. I feel like that speaks to me somehow about what it's like being alive. But this book, The Third Policeman, I read it when I was 17, and I think it was probably, if you had to say one book that motivated me to write, it'd be that, because I just had never read anything like it. In fact, I read it on my 17th birthday.
Oh, wow.
My uncle gave it to me. My uncle, my uncle Jeff, I'll name check him. He was quite a big influence on my reading habits. And now and again, when I reached a particular landmark birthday or something, he'd say, right, I think it's about time you're ready for this. So on my 17th birthday, he sent me this and said, this is one of the best books you'll ever read. You must read this. He didn't order me to read it on my birthday, but the inscription basically said, right, you're ready, do this. So I read it and I was mesmerized by how strange it was. It sometimes gets compared to like an Alice in Wonderland for adults type situation, or, you know, it's that kind of, where am I? Why am I in this world? Really funny, full of stupid footnotes, trickery, that, you know, all that sort of thing. Kind of a nerd's novel in a way, I suppose. And, yeah, I'd never seen anything like it, and I still couldn't name many novels like it, having read a lot more books since then. But yeah, the story of it is that he'd written this famous book, well, famous at the time, book called At Swim Two Birds. It was a big success. Flann O'Brien, not his real name, it was Brian O'Nolan, I think. He wrote in Irish and English. And then The Third Policeman was a not exactly a follow-up, but it was later on in his career, and the publishers just didn't like it. They thought it was too weird. I read all this in the foreword to the novel, or maybe there was an afternote. So I learned this, you know, at the same time. It's very odd that they thought it was too weird, because his other books are also absolutely bonkers, by the way. That's when all of his books were mad. So I don't know at what point, maybe a new editor came in and thought, never really liked this guy. And so I think about this quite a lot, that they didn't want to publish it. So he just hid the manuscript and pretended he'd lost it, which, these days is not something an author could really get away with. It amazes me to think of a time when there was one copy of your book existed and it was on paper. So you could claim that you just didn't know where it was anymore. or, you know, you hear about authors' books being destroyed in fires and stuff, and that's literally it. That's your 4 years work.
It's terrifying, isn't it?
Yeah, because even if you lose, I've lost a week of work before because I didn't back something up, and that feels like the end of the world. Imagine, I can't even... And it makes me feel funny to think about it.
So awful about that as well, is as soon as the awful thing happens, you just want someone to kind of sympathise and commiserate. The first thing anyone bloody says is, well, did you back it up? I'm like, no!
Absolutely, absolutely. And then they normally go on to say, you know, you really should back things up every day. Well, thank you, yes.
Never give anyone advice that requires time travel.
Don't give anyone advice, which is not so much advice, just a negative review of how well they've done. And so then obviously this book, The Third Policeman, at some point, somebody rediscovered it, published it posthumously, and it became a sort of cult classic among people like me. Like, in other words, I don't know, people that like weird comic novels, I suppose. And And then there's another twist, which is I read all this in 1997 when I was 17. And then about 10 years later, the book appeared in Lost, the American series. Someone was seen reading it on the desert island, and it immediately sparked all these speculation about whether it was, you know, a clue to the plot of Lost. So then suddenly thousands of people were buying it. And I loved it when that happened, but I also felt very melancholy that he'd been dead for 30 years. He died in 1966, I think. I ended up writing a dissertation on this guy at university. So that's, without doubt, I'd go back. I'd somehow find a way of persuading the publishers to publish it at the time, i.e. while he was, because I think he died, I don't know if he was an alcoholic, but big drinker, died disappointed, basically. And I would love to be able to, and not that old either. I guess he would still be dead by now, but I feel like I might be able to change the destiny of one guy by just knocking on the door of this place in Dublin and saying, I promise you, I come from the future, as you can see by my clothes, and loads of people are going to love this book. Let me blurb it now, I'll get it out for you.
If you wanted to write a sort of science fiction time-travelling book about you rediscovering Flann O'Brien and making him a legend in his own lifetime, I would read it now. I would take the rest of the day off and just crack up.
My worry is I don't think too many other people would feel like that. I think if I take that idea to my publisher and say this is the next book, they'd have some reservations.
I will blurb it, and I promise I won't say sweeping.
Thank you. Actually, maybe we can get this off the ground. If I write it this afternoon, you blurb it, we just put it out there and see what happens.
Awesome. Let's go. Mark, I could talk books for the rest of the day, but you've got this new Flann O'Brien book to write.
Yeah, I suppose I'd better get cracking with that, because I've got to pick my kids up in a couple of hours, so it doesn't leave me with a huge window.
Huge thanks to Mark. The Excellent Contact is out now. It's smart, funny, and incredibly moving. It does explore very sensitive issues connected with mental health and suicide. If you need help, or if there's someone that you're worried about, the Samaritans are available 24 hours a day. The number is 116123, or you can email joe@samaritans.org. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I have been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can follow us on social media at @YBooked. And if you've enjoyed this episode, it would make my day if you left us a 5-star review. It helps new listeners to find the podcast and get the word out. You can find a list of all the books mentioned by Mark at acast.com/booked. Finally, I leave you with this short, sweet quote from Barack Obama. Reading is what makes all other learning possible. See you next time.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.